This is January 27th, 2008, and I'm going to read and comment on miscellaneous words of the great Tang Dynasty Chan Master Zhao Zhou, whose name in Japan became Joshu. Joshu or Zhao Zhou. I'll stick with the Chinese. Sometimes I just can't try to pronounce Chinese names. This one is seems to be less difficult than others, so I'll go with the Chinese here. You know, the Japanese knew what they were doing when they changed these Chinese names to their own Japanese names, not just because of the difficulty of pronouncing them, because it made them more their own. Instead of these masters being foreigners, which in both China and Japan was tantamount to being some outer space being, when by rendering these Chinese names into more familiar Japanese sounds, they made them more their own. They feel to a Japanese, the name Joshu would, even though they know he's Chinese, it somehow makes it more intimate, more one's own, brings it in to one's own country more. I don't think this will be happening in the United States, changing the names. I think one reason is because we are so much more at ease about the diversity of nationalities and are so accustomed to, because of our melting pot heritage, to working with these different names from other countries. But from leaving aside the Japanese themselves, to us, for example, it's easy to think that Joshu is a Japanese master. I have to be really alert. That's why I so many times made this point that these are almost all the masters in all of the koans are Chinese masters, and none of them are Japanese. There's a popular notion that Zen is from Japan. It's not entirely false, but it originated in China. The Chan school, Zen school, originated in China. So here's a exchange between a monk and Zhao Zhou that many Sesshin participants have heard. A monk asked, "During each hour of the day, for 24 hours, how should I apply my mind?" Zhao Zhou said, "You are used by the hours. I use them. What is this time you are asking about?" You are used by the hours. I use them. Zhao Zhou is really, what he's saying applies to us as well. Almost all of us are used by the hours. We are driven by time. You know, it sounds almost conceited what Zhao Zhou is saying here. You're used by the hours, but I use them. Well, most people, these words uttered by most people, you could assume that there is a big distinction there between self and other. And that he's elevating himself above other people. But I would just ask to consider that since Zhao Zhou was one of the most illustrious of all the masters from the very beginning, that we consider that he must have been deeply enlightened. And then when he says, "I use the hours," he's not really singling himself out. He's not thinking of himself as separate from others. He's just making a point that there's a distinction between being used by the hours and using them. You know, all of these dialogues, everything we read about Zhao Zhou, every dialogue or koan involving Zhao Zhou as a master, puts him at the age of at least 80. It wasn't until 80 that he began teaching. So everything that I'll be reading today, because he's a master in each of these exchanges, he's at least 80, and we're told that he died at the age of 120. So not to get hooked by the words. In fact, these are translations. That's another thing we should never forget. Everything from China and Japan, of course, is translated. And in the English language, there are many times when we have to render most things with using the personal pronoun. Whereas in Japan and China, as in Spanish, you can usually get away without using the personal pronoun. So somehow he distinguished here between himself and others, but it may have come across in the original Chinese much more subtle distinction between himself and others. So what is the difference? You are used by the hours. Well, one is that the monk, the questioner, we know from his question that he's thinking in terms of time. Whereas in the deepest state of concentration or no-mindedness, we're beyond time. And that's why he says, Joshu says, as his last question, he says, "What is this time you are asking about?" When we are fully absorbed in what we're doing, we're beyond time. Because time is a notion. And when we're completely one with shoveling snow or drinking coffee or talking with someone, when we're completely one with it, there is no thought of time. I used to wonder what eternity was. It was so intriguing. Eternity. Where, how do I get there? What's that? Well, there it is. There it is. Beyond time. Beyond notions of time. It's the same thing. There is no time except in ideas, thoughts, concepts. Time is a concept. When it's not there, we are experiencing the eternal. Those who ask, how long will it take me to come to enlightenment? Or how long will it take me to really make progress? That very question shows an obstacle that they will have to get through in order to really make real progress. The very good word "progress" is a problem. Here's another one. A monk asked, "Master, Where is your mind focused? Zhao Zhou said, where there is no design. I love this one because it can be taken in two ways. It can be taken as design, like I have designs on you, meaning I have plans for you. I have an agenda that I want to bring to you. In which case, Zhao Zhou is saying, where there is no agenda, no notion of enlightenment in the future, progress, this or that, failure or success, right or wrong, where there's no calculating, no design in the sense of calculating, no plans. I know it's an old saying that, an old expression that if a man is, say, interested in a woman, he has designs on her. So here he could be saying where there is no desire, no craving, no wanting to get something. And the other is a little, another way to understand it is a little broader, more subtle and more profound, is where there is no form. In our zazen, we encounter thought forms, images in the mind. But if there is any image, any thought, any configuration of practice in the mind, we still have further to go. As long as, for example, the koan mu, as long as that mu has any shape to it, any contrast, in other words, if there's any two-ness, any, that old dichotomy, the figure and the ground, the form and the space, the non-form, if there's anything like that at all to it, if there's any design at all to how we see our practice, then it doesn't mean that we're in a superficial state with our practice, but it means that we're not all the way. There is still further to go. It's so difficult to conceive of the formless. I mean, it is inconceivable. We use these words. The Buddha used to point out how words can be utter fabrications of the intellect. They don't have to point to reality. He used as an example the child of a barren woman. It doesn't exist. It's just a plaything of words. So to see beyond the world of form, the world of appearances, is to be confronted with the inconceivable, that which cannot be pictured or thought about. That's why it's so difficult. But out of habit, the mind is always trying to render this reality, this truth, in terms of forms, thought forms, or pictures, shapes. There's another one. Zhao Zhou said, he quoted Bodhidharma saying, "Those who are outside attain the skin. Those who are inside attain the bones." And then he himself says, "Tell me, the one who is even more inside, what does he gain?" This, he's referring back to a challenge from Bodhidharma, the founder of Zen, in the 6th century or 5th or 6th century, who summoned his three leading disciples, and he asked them to give a word of truth. And the first one gave a certain explanation. He said, you've attained my skin. And the second one gave an explanation of some kind, a little more profound and subtle. He said, you have my flesh. And then the third one, he said, and gave his answer, and he said, you have my bones. And then the fourth one remained silent, and he said, you have the marrow, my marrow. So just progressive depths of understanding. So he quotes Bodhidharma, Zhao Zhao quotes Bodhidharma saying, those who are inside attain the bones. Then what's beyond that? The one who is even more inside, what does he gain? A monk came forward and said, would it not be reasonable to say that he gains the marrow? Zhao Zhou said, just get to the skin. At my place, I'm not concerned about the marrow. And the monk asked, what is the marrow? The marrow, if anyone doesn't know here, a marrow is the inside of the bones, the very, very inside. The monk asked, what is the marrow? Zhao Zhou said, in this way, you will not even get to the skin. As long as you're asking to be told, to be given the truth, as long as you're looking outside yourself for the essence, then you won't get anywhere. Monk asked, what is the principal concern of the one wearing Buddhist robes? Zhao Zhou said, not to deceive himself. So the question is really, what is the principal concern of the Dharma practitioner? What does it all come down to? Not to deceive herself. This one also, I think, is really, really captures so much of what this work is all about. Recognizing that we can only be aware of what we're aware of. My experience in my many years of practice is that in many, many junctures along the way, we can think, this is it. Oh, all right. Oh, I thought it was that, but it's this. And then we go on, and then same thing. Oh, what a fool. I thought it was that, but it's this. And so forth. It's a never-ending process of discovery. Not to mention, just on a psychological level, there's so many ways we deceive ourselves. There's so many ways that the mind tricks us. The self-deceptions that we discover over time, and who knows what other ways that we're doing that. It's why it's essential as a real student of the Dharma, to always have some skepticism about one's perceptions. That yes, you can feel quite certain that you've seen things as they are, but who knows? How do we know? This is the great danger of opinions. It's a basic principle in practice to not cling to one's opinions, because our vision is imperfect. We're not seeing the whole, no matter where we are in our practice. Short of, I guess, full enlightenment, we're not seeing things perfectly clearly, which means we're not seeing things perfectly completely from all sides. Our vision is limited to one degree or another. And then how much more so, as just kind of a sidebar here, how much more to be skeptical or cautious about what we hear and read in the media. This was a big revelation to me when I realized that everything that we think we know secondhand relies on the source. So everything we think we know about Iraq, the presidential candidates, medical information, let's just keep it to news for a minute. What we hear about anyone or anything is we're entrusting ourselves to the source. And we know how unreliable, I mean, how flawed, how imperfect the media are, whether it's TV or computer or internet or newspapers, magazines. How do we know? I actually said this before we invaded Iraq. I made this point. How do we know that there are, I mean, I have to say, full disclosure, I said at the time, I tend to believe that there are weapons of mass destruction, because at the time it was pretty compelling, quite a bit of unanimity about that. But how do we know? I said, how do we ever know for sure? A monk asked, "The permanent, what is it?" Zhao Zhou said, "That which is impermanent." The monk asked, "Why is the permanent impermanent?" Zhao Zhou said, "Life, life." This is one of these dichotomies where it just depends on how you look at the truth, the reality. From one side, reality always has two sides to it. So from one side, you could say, cite a basic teaching of Buddhist doctrine, the Dharma, which is that everything is impermanent. Everything is impermanent. And that's true. But then there's a permanence to that impermanence. It's sort of an ironclad law that everything is impermanent. And so we could say that if you want to, in words, to cover all the ground, you could say that within impermanence there is the permanent. Within change, there is the changeless. Within the changeless, there is change. Once in Taisho, I made this point very forcefully that everything is impermanent. Everything is change. We are change. Everything is in flux. And afterwards, someone took issue with that and came to me and said, "Well, isn't it?" Or wrote, I can't remember. This is many years ago, and said, "Well, what about the changeless, the permanent? What about that?" I said, "Yeah, that too." Zhaozhou says, "Life, life." It all depends on how you look at it. Someone asked Zhaozhou, "When one is confronted with disaster, how can one avoid it?" Zhaozhou said, "That's it." Here's one that a monk asked. "I am a stupid person." This is a kind of a matter of etiquette in ancient China. Often, as you would have this, take this self-effacing position and lower yourself before the teacher. "I am a stupid person, floating, sinking, floating, sinking. How can I be released from the suffering of this world?" Zhaozhou just kept sitting silently. The monk said, "Master, am I not sitting here appealing to you?" Zhaozhou said, "Where on earth is it that you are floating and sinking?" He's trying to point out to the student, to the monk, that he's conjured up these notions, these images. You know, there's certain students who do this more than others, where they get into sort of the drama of their images. This great suffering, the sea of suffering in the world, and here I am bobbing up and down, ascending and descending, evolving and devolving in the six realms of existence, the samsara. And then Zhaozhou just cutting through all that. "Where on earth is it that you're floating and sinking? Get that stuff out of your mind. As long as you're thinking about yourself, going through all this, you're nowhere." Someone asked, "When the one heading for deliverance vows to strive for the utmost enlightenment, how about that?" Zhaozhou said, "When not yet delivered, you are used by enlightenment. When delivered, you use it." Let's change this to liberate. "When the one heading for liberation vows to strive for the utmost enlightenment, how about that? When not yet liberated, you are used by enlightenment. When liberated, you use it." So the first one, "When not yet liberated, you are used by enlightenment." You are fettered by the notion of enlightenment, the picture of it, the thought of it, the image of it, as a goal out there, something in the future apart from you. You're used by it. When liberated, you use it. You use it by having seen through it, by having discarded such thoughts, because you've seen that enlightenment is the nature of all of us. We are all we all equally are endowed with this enlightened nature. And to the extent that we see into that, we have no use for the thought of it anymore. We have no use for that dualism, enlightenment and delusion, the enlightened and the unenlightened. Instead, at that point, one just acts out of one's seeing through that dichotomy of enlightenment and unenlightenment. And that's using it. Somebody asked Zhao Zhou, what is the link between Buddha and Bodhidharma? Zhao Zhou said, nothing leaks out. So Buddha and Bodhidharma, again, the founder of Zen, there was something like, let's see, oh, 900 years, I guess, between Buddha and Bodhidharma. 800, maybe. So what's the link between them? Nothing leaks out. What is the link between Buddha and us? Nothing leaks out. Someone asked, someone quoted Basso, a previous great Chinese master. It is not mind, it is not Buddha, it is not things. And he said, this expresses the essence in terms of negation. How can it be said affirmatively? Zhao Zhou said, above the heavens and below the heavens, I alone, the world-honored one. Zen is fond, the masters are fond of expressing the truth negatively. Buddha famously said, it's not this, it's not that. Because as soon as you say things in the affirmative, you risk limiting it. If you say, everything comes down to oneness, which is one way of speaking of the last exchange we just read. Nothing leaks out. But as soon as we say everything comes down to oneness, then that limits it. It puts a kind of a box around this illimitable, boundless reality. So to put it in terms of the negative doesn't do that. It's not this and it's not that. It's not form, it's not no form. It's not words and it's not silence. These are all ways that the truth has been expressed, and it keeps it open. And so Basso, when he was asked, what is Buddha, or you could say, what is enlightenment? He said, it's not mind, it's not Buddha, it's not things. So now he leaves things open. But then this monk is asking, how would you say it affirmatively? And Zhao Zhou says, above the heavens and below them. He's quoting the Buddha, who's according to legend, after he was born, he took seven steps, raised his hand up and said these words, above the heavens, below the heavens. In other words, throughout all space, everywhere, I alone, the world-honored one. This too can be misunderstood as him coming out of the, well, I guess it was in the womb, wherever it was, I am the world savior. I am the ultimate. I am a kind of God. But he's not saying that, really. He didn't mean that. I mean, it's still a legend, but let's say he said it. I alone. Divide the word alone. It becomes all one. I alone, the world honored one. With someone of Zhao Zhou's stature, his age, some monks would tend to read too much into his responses, as this monk did when he asked, "What is the ultimate word?" Zhao Zhou coughed. The monk said, "That's it, isn't it?" Zhao Zhou said, "Alas, they won't even let me cough." Someone asked, "Naturalness, what is that?" Zhao Zhou said, "This asking is in itself unnatural." Now, here are two ways to see this asking. From the ultimate perspective, to ask what anything is still to be in a state of imperfect understanding. So long as we can raise a question about something, this is the function of the discriminating mind. But from a practice point of view, that's one side of it, the ultimate. But from a practice point of view, this asking is hugely powerful. So, for example, to change the question, to ask, "Who am I?" is still to be somewhat in the dark about one's self nature. But if one is in the dark, if one is still has less than perfect understanding, then question. Don't apologize for having questioning, for wondering, "Who am I? What is this? What am I doing here? What is the meaning of my life?" These questions, through decades of practice, these questions lose their bite and eventually can just dissolve. And that's a state of great freedom and rest, peace of mind. But until then, those very questions lead us into that, can have the power to lead us into that state of freedom, that state of quiet stillness. Naturalness, what is that? This asking is in itself unnatural. A monk asked, "Does the oak tree also have Buddha nature?" He's referring to a famous response where a monk asked about what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming in the West, or one of those questions, what is the ultimate? And Zhao Zhou said, "The oak tree in the front garden." Sometimes it's translated as the cypress tree in the front garden. So here the monk is alluding to that and says, "Does the oak tree also have Buddha nature?" Zhao Zhou said, "It does." It's a different response than what the monk got who was asking about a dog. Does even a dog have Buddha nature? Zhao Zhou famously said, moo. Which literally means no or not. But the literal meaning was not the point of that response. Now he says, does the oak tree also have Buddha nature? It does. The monk asked, when will it attain enlightenment? This is not a beginner. You know, that's one thing to always keep in mind, that some of these monks were deeply enlightened themselves, and they were just going up to Joshu to try to get some kind of back and forth going, to test his understanding, to see how he would respond. Monk asked, will it attain enlightenment? Zhao Zhou said, it is waiting for the sky to fall. The monk said, when will the sky fall? Zhao Zhou said, it is waiting for the oak tree to attain enlightenment. So here Zhao Zhou is basically saying, okay, you want to pose these, play this game, then let me just circle around, bring it back, and leave you with nothing to hold on to. Here's a monk who is too clever by half. He says, I will not ask anything in particular. So please, Master, do not give any particular answer. Zhao Zhou said, how strange. Someone asked, the way of the monk, what is it? Zhao Zhou said, being detached from the way. Not being attached to thoughts of the way, of course, he means. Again and again and again, Zen comes back to the same thing, which is not reifying concepts or thoughts. Reify means to imagine to be real or substantial, to make what is what doesn't exist into what does exist in the mind. And I think this is a real basic way to understand the work of Zen, is to not not to make thoughts or concepts into something, not to make them into anything, but to avoid doing that, we have to notice when thoughts and concepts are in the mind. And many thoughts and concepts are so deeply ingrained that we don't see them as thoughts and concepts. We just see them as the way things are. This goes back to an earlier response from Joshua, not to deceive himself. What is the principal concern of the one wearing Buddhist robe? Not to deceive himself. The deception is in not recognizing thoughts and concepts as thoughts and concepts. And any insight can be turned into a thought or concept. Just as we were saying, oh yes, everything is one. But if we carry that around as a thought, then it's a thought. Someone asked, what is the living link with Buddha? Zhao Zhou said, no one else knows. Don't look to anyone else. Only you can know this through your direct experience. A monk saw a cat and asked Zhao Zhou, "I call it a cat. Master, what do you call it?" Zhao Zhou said, "You calling it a cat." The monk was presenting things in static terms. It, reality. I call this great reality, I call a cat. Sure, why not? Call it a cat. Call it a tree. Call it a car. And then he asked Zhao Zhou. Zhao Zhou won't limit it to something static, an object, a thing. What is it? You calling it a cat. This it, this reality, is not, can't be limited to an object or to a principle or a concept, a physical thing. It is process also. It is things in process, things happening. It's dynamic. You calling it a cat. You could say, what is mu? No, mu. I call it mu. Master, what do you call it? You calling it mu. Are you questioning mu? That's it. The questioning itself, the absorption itself is it. Well, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.